Take it, most of us here, parents, we've heard about the terrible twos. Terrible twos. Something about when a child turns two that you really start to see the effects of the fall in children. Anyone else here experiencing that? We are at the moment. Now, theologians, on a serious note, theologians call this total depravity. Total depravity doesn't mean that two-year-olds are as wicked and evil as Adolf Hitler. What it means is that every aspect of our being as humans is affected by sin. And we see this very early on with children, okay? Parents don't teach their children how to be greedy or to lie, do they? Kids figure that out all by themselves. But the terrible twos are so-called because children start to say no to everything at this age. You know, pick up your toys. No. Fight mum and dad on this one. Put your pajamas under your pillow. No. Get in the bath. No. At age two, the children are getting to the point where they don't want to be controlled anymore, even by loving parents who are just, you know, looking out for them. And they fight you on it. They're testing their boundaries, all right, and they're just fighting you on every front. Anything they don't want to do themselves. And the terrible twos, I think, are a micro picture of the fall itself, when Adam and Eve said no to God. They said, look, God, you don't own me, and I'm going to do what I want. And ever since that point, humanity has had this irrational hostility to the notion that God, as our creator, is also our owner. Just like a two-year-old, humanity has treated God like this untrustworthy parent that they don't want to be doing what they're told. And this is what we see in our passage today. We're looking at three episodes. It's a long passage. We're not going to be able to look at every verse in detail. But what these three passages have in common is they show us how Israel had said to God, you don't own me. Now, just like Adam, Israel have opted for her own rules. And in this passage, Jesus tells Israel that her days are numbered. You cannot go on treating God shamefully like some untrustworthy parent forever. But while this passage is specifically about Israel, this is the story of us all, is it not? We all have this inbuilt tendency to resist the notion that God owns us, to resist the notion that we're his creation. And what Israel teaches us is that even being one of God's people does not make us immune to this tendency. So some of the things we're going to be looking at today might be very familiar to many of us here. Now what we want to do is we want to eradicate these tendencies from our lives, but in order to do that, we first need to identify them. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to identify them and then see if we can deal with them in our lives. So how about I pray and then we'll begin. Our Heavenly Father, we come before you this morning like two-year-old children. We know you're good, but we still fight against your will for our lives. We ask that you'll guide us this morning as we go about identifying those areas of our lives that we're resisting your will. And when we've singled them out, Lord, we ask that you'll strengthen us to eradicate them from your lives. And just personally, Lord, now I just want to ask you that you will use my words to impact and inspire us all to be more like how you want us to be. Amen. So last week, we looked at Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem. Okay, and as soon as Jesus enters Jerusalem, what is the very first thing he does? He goes to the temple, verse 45. The temple was the place where God's people were to worship him, worship Yahweh. Because God had chosen to dwell in the temple in a special way under the old covenant. So when Solomon first dedicated the temple in 1 Kings 8, he says, look, even the heavens cannot contain God. It's not like this is a little house for God to live in. The heavens can't contain him. But this place is a special place where God's people were to pray to Yahweh and also to come to seek his forgiveness. Now, as Christians, this is a little foreign to us. Jesus tells us that we now worship God in spirit. We don't go to a special place. We worship him in spirit. We don't need a temple. We don't even need this church building. This building is here simply as a roof over our heads. But for those under the Old Covenant, in the Old Testament, the temple was where God's people met to worship Yahweh. But when Jesus enters the temple, he finds temple worship in jeopardy. Have a look at verse 45. When Jesus entered the temple courts, he began to drive out those who were selling. "It is written," he said to them, "my house will be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers." Now, Luke spends two verses on clearing the temple, but don't let its brevity underestimate what is going on here. We have a single man, right, a single man driving out dozens of animal sellers, of animals, and of money changers. And the only way, look, I think there's two things going on here. This is another act of God, but it is an act of anger. Jesus must have hit the roof for him to be able to, as one man, drive out these dozens of people and animals. And he's angry because God's house is being misused. That's what he's angry about. I heard a story this week of some tenants from hell. They moved into the new rental property, and within 3 weeks, they had set up and converted the rear bathroom into a meth lab. All right? Making and selling drugs. Now, if I were that landlord, I would be very angry. Them using my property for that kind of purpose. And that's what's going on here. The Israelites, some in particular, are misusing God's house. Instead of using it as a place of worship, they've turned it into a flea market. Now, it's not the presence of animals or coins for the temple tax that's the problem. You needed coins for the temple tax. You needed animals in the temple. All right. The problem is that the people were using the worship of Yahweh for personal gain. Instead of the temple being a place where you come to meet with God, where you come to worship God, where you come to seek forgiveness for God, for where you come to pray to God, verse 46, they were using it for their own personal monetary gain. And that is not what worship is about. A worship is not what I can get out of it. Worship is about what I can put in for God. The dictionary definition of worship, I looked it up. This is just an internet dictionary. It says, worship is a feeling of profound love and admiration. A feeling of profound love and admiration. Now, Romans chapter 12 sharpens this a bit for us by telling us how we do this. We do it by offering our bodies as living sacrifices. Now, what does that mean? It means everything we do should be for God. The way we express our profound love and admiration is by doing what he wants. These people were not doing that. Now, there will be some people in the church today, not necessarily here, but the worldwide church, who do use the worship of God for their own monetary gain. My guess is that's not us here. I don't see people coming to church to make money. All right? But that doesn't mean that all too pervasive attitude of what's in it for me isn't present here. You see, our current generation of churchgoers, I think, is the most consumeristic of any generation before it. We all come to church saying, what's in it for me? What can I get out of this church? What is this church going to do for me? The problem is, that's the kind of attitude that led Jesus to clear the temple. Now, I take it we don't want this. So how do we protect against it? How do we ensure that if Jesus visited our church, he wouldn't be wanting to get the whip out? Well, it's quite simple. When we come to church, don't come to church thinking about yourself. Don't sit there thinking, this music and preaching has to suit me. Don't sit there thinking, these people need to serve me. Right? We need to come to church thinking about others. thinking, you know what, maybe some other people like this song or like this preacher. Maybe I can serve them in some way. Think about how you can serve others. Come to church thinking how we can serve God and his people rather than how God and his people can serve me. That's how we avoid Jesus' anger in this instance. Come to church thinking about how I can serve. And if you're sitting there today thinking, well, I don't know how I can serve, please come and see me afterwards. I'm sure we can find somewhere where you would be enjoying serving God. But it's not just the sellers who are in Jesus' sights here. The Jewish leadership is just as liable. I mean, the sellers would not have been able to set up shop in the temple courts if the chief priests and teachers of the law hadn't let them. And so in clearing the temple courts, what Jesus is basically saying is those who let these people in, they're in the wrong. And their authority is in question. And the leaders know their authority is being questioned here. So they confront Jesus about his authority. This is chapter 20, verse 1. One day as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple courts. So notice, he's cleared the temple courts for what? To do the right thing, to teach. All right? Teaching people in the temple courts and proclaiming the good news. The chief priests and teachers of the law, together with the elders, came up to him. Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things, they said. Who gave you this authority? So what they're basically doing is they're saying, Jesus, show us your license. All right? This is our turf. If you think you're going to be able to kick us out, we're going to need to see your credentials on this one. Show us your license. Well, in response, Jesus asked them a question about authority. There's all authority going on everywhere here. And Jesus is saying, look, if you can answer my question on authority, then I'll answer your question on authority. And the question is simple. Verse 4, John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? We've got Jesus' sheer brilliance on show again here. This is a brilliant question. Because it calls the chief priest's authority into question in a very sharp way. You see, if they are not capable of judging John and his ministry, then they're not capable to judge Jesus and his authority. And we're let in on the Pharisees' conversation here. We get to see them squirm over this question. Have a look at verse 5. They discussed it among themselves. They said, look, if we say from heaven, then he'll ask, well, why didn't you believe him? But if we say of human origin, all the people will stone us because they are persuaded that John was a prophet. Now, this is the religious and philosophical elite of Israel. And they answered, we don't know where it was from. Don't know. Going to have to, you know, call a government inquiry on this one. Royal commission. Don't know. Now, the reason that the chief priests take this cowardly way out is because of two things, pride and power. They don't want to lose their position of honor in the community, and they don't want to lose their position of power in the community. Pride and power. And pride and power are two of Satan's most favorite but also most destructive weapons. President Bashar al-Assad is an example. He's more interested in clutching onto power than in actually doing his job of looking after his people. And so he's killing them by the thousands. How about the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan? I heard one report that said the management of that power station waited hours before they finally raised the alarm. Why? Because Japan is a shame-based culture. And they were more interested in saving face than protecting those in their care. Let's see if we can put some sort of cap on this before we get shamed. Satan loves proud people, and he loves power-hungry people, because those people will do unthinkable acts to keep their reputations and their power. How do we protect against these two evils? We don't want to be those kinds of people. What do we do? Well, with pride, we need to remember to be poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. That's how we protect against pride. Now, what this means is we need to remember our spiritual bankruptcy. And when we remember that we have nothing of value to offer God, that by ourselves we are spiritually worthless, then pride goes out the window, doesn't it? It's pointless me trying to protect or preserve my reputation because it's beyond repair. Anything good you see before you today is only because of Jesus. Without Jesus, I am a wicked sinner, destined for hell. That's how you protect against pride. Remember that you have none. How do we protect against a hunger for power? We need to be meek. Blessed are the meek. Now, meek does not equal weak. To be meek, you need a lot of strength and a lot of power. Jesus says this, "Do you think that I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" That's Jesus. But he chose not to. He chose to be meek. Meekness means whatever power God has given you, maybe it's a position of authority at work, at church, in the home. To be meek means we don't use that power for our own benefit. We use it to serve others. And that's how you protect against a hunger for power. Well, we have a blatant misuse of authority here by the Jewish leaders. And it leads Jesus to tell what is arguably probably his most pointed parable. The parable of the vineyard. Now, the parable of the vineyard, it seems a little foreign to some of us. We're thinking, oh, who's what in this? For Jesus' original listeners, this parable was like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It was very familiar to them. The reason it was familiar was because all the way back in Isaiah chapter 5, God told a story, a parable about a vineyard, and in that parable, he identifies Israel as the vineyard. Okay? He says, I planted a vineyard, and I loved the vineyard, and I cared for the vineyard, and I tended that vineyard. But, God says in Isaiah 5, that vineyard has failed to produce fruit. So what I'm going to do is I'm no longer going to tend my vineyard, and I'm going to let it fall into ruin. And as the Israelites in Jesus' day knew, that happened in the Babylonian exile. God let them come in and ruin his vineyard. Now, when Jesus mentions the vineyard, the Israelites know, oh, he's talking about us. But Jesus puts a bit of a twist on this parable from Isaiah 5. You see, in Luke 20, the Israelites are now the tenants. The vineyard represents God's blessing on those tenants. He says, all right, here's my people. Come on in to my vineyard and you'll be blessed. This is my blessing. But God still expects fruit in return for this blessing. Have a look at verse 10. At harvest time, the owner, God, sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. The tenants are not interested in sharing the fruit that they have produced with God. They want to keep this fruit for themselves. Now, God deals very graciously with the Israelites by sending a second servant, a second prophet, and then a third. Yet Israel doesn't listen to God's prophets. Instead, they mistreat God's prophets. Now, a normal owner at this point in time, right, what would you be doing? You'd be calling the authorities, you'd go in there, and you would kick them out by force. But God goes beyond what is normally humanly reasonable here. He's already given them chance after chance after chance after chance, and Israel have rejected all of those chances, so what does God do next? He gives them one last chance. He sends his son, Jesus. And Jesus has come to see if he can get the fruit from his people. The tenants, however, in a display of, you know, just irrational logic, don't know what's going on in their minds, but they think, look, if we kill the son, then we'll get to inherit the blessing, inherit the vineyard. Jesus wraps up the parable with a question, verse 15. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Now the crowd, remember, they're very familiar with this story. They know exactly who the tenants are, and they cried in verse 16, what is it? God forbid, may this never happen. How horrifying for God to take his blessing away from Israel and give it to Gentiles. God forbid. They're reeling at this idea. But while they're reeling at this idea, Jesus slaps them again with another question about a rock. A special rock. This is a rock that was rejected by builders, but God has chosen it as his cornerstone, his foundation stone. A cornerstone was the big stone that went in the corner, and the weight of two walls, most of the house, went on that stone. Jesus is saying that this cornerstone has been chosen by God. And the most catastrophic decision anyone can make is to reject God's stone, to reject Jesus. Everything from now on is going to be built around him. If you trip over him or reject him, you'll be crushed. Now, the incredible thing about Jesus is that the wicked thing these people did to Jesus, all right, they killed God's cornerstone. That very act is the means by which God opens up salvation for them and for us. The cross is where we see the hostility, our hostility to God, meet God's grace to us. And what the cross means, and this is what we need to understand today, is that God is not just our owner as our creator. God owns us as redeemer now. The Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, you are not your own. You were bought at a price. What this means is that everything that you and I have is not ours. It belongs to God. Every time I use my mind, I'm using something that belongs to God. Every time I use my body, I'm using something that belongs to God. My time, my finances, my children, my sexuality, they are all fundamentally God's. And just like with Israel, God expects fruit in return for all this blessing. So, how do we protect against being poor tenants? If you're a Christian, you no doubt want to be producing fruit for God rather than keeping it all for yourself. How do we protect against this desire that battles within us to keep everything for ourselves? Well, friends, we do it by realizing that God owns us. But God's ownership is not some like a slave trading kind of ownership. You and I are God's treasured possession. His treasured possession. And when we realize this, we will understand that beneath our life is God's hand. He's holding us and blessing us. You see, if we are resting in God's hand, then we can go through life with our hands open. That's what fruit for God means, having your hands open. If we believe God's hand is not there, right, then I'm going to hold on to everything I have very tightly. If that's all there is, I'm going to hold on to my money, my love, my approval, my time, my energy, my family. If God's not there, that's all I have. The way to hold on to those kinds of things loosely, though, to give our fruit to God, our time, our money, our love, our respect, our family, is to realize that God's hand is under us and that his hand is good. He is a giver, not a taker. Friends, the vineyard owner is not just our creator, he is our redeemer, and he deserves our fruit. Let's not be like the vineyard's previous tenants. Let us be people who acknowledge our owner, love our owner, and live to please him rather than ourselves.